17. When my father and Chester got me back to Boise, the next day, they discovered that Dr. Horstowski could not, or did not want to, treat me. He did, however, give me several psychological tests for the purpose of diagnosis. One, I remember, involved listening to a tape of voices which mumbled at a distance, only a few phrases now and then being at all distinguishable. The task was to write down what each of their successive conversations was about. I think Horstowski made his diagnosis on my results in that test, because I heard each conversation as dealing with me. In detail, I heard them outlining my faults, outlining my failings, analyzing me for what I was, diagnosing my behavior. I heard them insulting both me and Pris and our relationship. All Horstowski said was merely, "Louis, each time you heard the word this, you thought they were saying Pris." That seemed to make him despondent. And what you thought was Louis was, generally speaking, the two words, "do we." He glanced at me bleakly and thereupon washed his hands of me. I was not out of the reach of the psychiatric profession, however, because Dr. Horstowski turned me over to the Federal Commissioner of the Bureau of Mental Health in Area 5, the Pacific Northwest. I had heard of him. His name was Dr. Raglan Nizia, and it was his job to make a final determination on all commitment proceedings originating in this area. Single-handed, since 1980, he had committed many thousands of disturbed people to the Bureau's clinics scattered around the country. He was considered a brilliant psychiatrist and diagnostician, and it had been a joke for years among us that sooner or later we would all fall into Nizia's hands. It was a joke everyone made, and which a certain percentage of us lived to see come true. "You'll find Dr. Nizia to be capable and sympathetic," Horstowski told me as he drove me over to the Bureau's office in Boise. "It's nice of you to take me over," I said. "I'm in and out of there every day. I'd have to make this trip anyhow. What I'm doing is sparing you the appearance in court and the jury costs. As you know, Nizia makes final determination anyhow, and you're better off in his hands than before a lay jury." I nodded. It was so. "You're not feeling hostile about this, are you?" Horstowski asked. "It's no stigma to be placed in a Bureau clinic. Happens every minute of the day. 1 out of 9 people have crippling mental illness, which makes it impossible for them." He droned on. I paid no attention. I had heard it all before, on the countless TV ads, in the infinitely many magazine articles. But as a matter of fact, I did feel hostile toward him for washing his hands of me and turning me over to the mental health people, even though I knew that by law, he was required to if he felt I was psychotic. And I felt hostile toward everyone else, including the two simulacra. As we drove through the sunny, familiar streets of Boise between his office and the Bureau, I felt that everyone was a betrayer and enemy of mine, that I was surrounded by an alien, hating world. All this and much more had, of course, shown up in the tests which Horstowski had given me. In the Rorschach test, for instance, I had interpreted each blot and picture as full of crashing, banging, jagged machinery designed from the start of time to swing into frantic, lethal motion with the intention of doing me bodily injury. In fact, on the drive over to the Bureau to see Dr. Nizia, I distinctly saw lines of cars following us, due, no doubt, to my being back in town. The people in the cars had been tipped off the moment I arrived at the Boise airport. "Can Dr. Nizia help me?" I asked Horstowski as we slid to the curb by a large modern office building of many floors and windows. Now I had begun to feel acute panic. I mean, the mental health people have all those new techniques which even you don't have, all the latest...
"It depends on what you mean by help," Horstowski said, opening the car door and beckoning me to accompany him into the building.
So here I stood at last, where so many had come before me, the Federal Bureau of Mental Health, in its diagnostic division, the first step, perhaps, in a new era of my life. How right Pris had been when she had told me that I had within me a deeply unstable streak which someday might bring me into trouble. Hallucinated, weary and hopeless,
I had at last been taken into tow by the authorities, as she herself had been a few years ago. I had not seen Horstowski's diagnosis, but I knew without asking that he had found schizophrenic responses in me. I felt them inside me, too. Why deny what was obvious? I was lucky that help, on a vast collective scale, was available for me. God knew I was wretched in such a state, close to suicide or to total collapse from which there might be no recovery. And they had caught it so early. There was a distinct hope for me. Specifically, I realized I was in the early catatonic excitement stage, before any permanent maladjustment pattern such as the dreaded hebephrenia or paranoia had set in. I had the illness in its simple, original form, where it was still accessible to therapy. I could thank my father and brother for their timely action. And yet, although I knew all this, I accompanied Horstowski into the Bureau's office in a state of trembling dread, conscious still of my hostility and of the hostility all around me. I had insight, and yet I did not. One part of me knew and understood. The rest seethed like a captured animal that yearns to get back to its own environment, its own familiar places. At this moment, I could speak for only a small portion of my mind, while the remainder went its own way. This made clear to me the reasons why the McHeston Act was so necessary. A truly psychotic individual, such as myself, could on his own never seek aid. He had to be coerced by law. That was what it meant to be psychotic. Pris, I thought, you were like this once. They caught you there in school, picked you out, and separated you from the others, hauled you off as I'm being hauled off. And they did manage to restore you to your society. Can they succeed with me? And, I thought, will I be like you when the therapy is over? What former, more adjusted state in my history will they restore me to? How will I feel about you, then? Will I remember you? And if I do, will I still care about you as I do now? Dr. Horstowski deposited me in the public waiting room, and I sat for an hour with all the other bewildered, sick people, until at last a nurse came and summoned me. In a small inner office, I was introduced to Dr. Nizia. He turned out to be a good-looking man, not much older than myself, with soft brown eyes, thick hair that was well-combed, and a cautious, apologetic manner, which I had never encountered outside the field of veterinary medicine. The man had a sympathetic interest, which he displayed at once, making sure that I was comfortable and that I understood why I was there. I said, "I'm here because I no longer have any basis by which I can communicate my wants and emotions to other humans." While waiting, I had been able to work it out exactly. "So, for me, there's no longer any possibility of satisfying my needs in the world of real people. I have to turn inward to a fantasy life instead." Leaning back in his chair, Dr. Nizia studied me reflectively. "And this you want to change?" "I want to achieve satisfaction, the real kind." "Have you nothing at all in common with other people?" "Nothing. My reality lies entirely outside the world that others experience. You, for instance. To you, it would be a fantasy if I told you about it. About her, I mean." "Who is she?" "Pris," I said. He waited, but I did not go on. "Dr. Horstowski talked to me briefly on the phone about you," he said presently. "You apparently have the dynamism of difficulty, which we call the magna mater type of schizophrenia. However, by law, I must administer first the James Benjamin Proverb test to you, and then the Soviet Vygotsky-Luria block test." He nodded, and from behind me a nurse appeared with notepad and pencil. "Now, I will give you several proverbs, and you are to tell me what they mean. Are you ready?"
"Yes," I said.
"When the cat's away, the mice will play."
I pondered and then said, "In the absence of authority, there will be wrongdoing." In this manner, we continued, and I did all right, until Dr. Nizia got to what turned out for me to be the fatal number 6. "A rolling stone gathers no moss."
Try as I might, I could not remember the meaning. At last I hazarded, "Well, it means a person who's always active and never pauses to reflect." No, that didn't sound right. I tried again. "That means a man who is always active and keeps growing in mental and moral stature won't grow stale." He was looking at me more intently, so I added, by way of clarification, "I mean, a man who's active and doesn't let grass grow under his feet, he'll get ahead in life." Dr. Nizia said, "I see." And I knew that I had revealed, for the purposes of legal diagnosis, a schizophrenic thinking disorder. "What does it mean?" I asked. "Did I get it backward?" "Yes, I'm afraid so. The generally accepted meaning of the proverb is the opposite of what you've given. It is generally taken to mean that a person who..." "You don't have to tell me," I broke in. "I remember. I really knew it. A person who's unstable will never acquire anything of value." Dr. Nizia nodded and went on to the next proverb. But the stipulation of the statute had been met. I showed a formal thinking impairment. After the proverbs, I made a stab at classifying the blocks, but without success. Both Dr. Nizia and I were relieved when I gave up and pushed the blocks away. "What does it mean?" I asked. "Did I get it backward?" "Yes, I'm afraid so. The generally accepted meaning of the proverb is the opposite of what you've given. It is generally taken to mean that a person who..." "You don't have to tell me," I broke in. "I remember. I really knew it. A person who's unstable will never acquire anything of value." Dr. Nizia nodded and went on to the next proverb. But the stipulation of the statute had been met. I showed a formal thinking impairment. After the proverbs, I made a stab at classifying the blocks, but without success. Both Dr. Nizia and I were relieved when I gave up and pushed the blocks away. "That's about it, then," Nizia said. He nodded to the nurse to leave. "We can go ahead and fill out the forms. Do you have a preference, clinic-wise? In my opinion, the best of the lot is the Los Angeles one, although perhaps it's because I know that better than the others. The Kasanin Clinic at Kansas City..." "Send me there," I said eagerly. "Any special reason?" "I've had a number of close friends come out of there," I said evasively. He looked at me as if he suspected there was a deeper reason. "And it has a good reputation. Almost everyone I know who's been genuinely helped in their mental illness has been at Kasanin. Not that the other clinics aren't good, but that's the best. My Aunt Gretchen, who's at the Harry Stack Sullivan Clinic at San Diego. She was the first mentally ill person I knew, and there have been a lot since. Naturally, because such a large part of the public has it, as we're told every day on TV. There was my cousin, Leo Rogers. He's still in one of the clinics somewhere. My English teacher in high school, Mr. Haskins. He died in a clinic. There was an old Italian down the street from me who was on a pension, George Oliveri. He had catatonic excitements, and they carted him off. I remember a buddy of mine in the service, Art Bowles. He had phrenia and went to the Fromm Reichman Clinic at Rochester, New York. There was Elise Johnson, a girl I went with in college. She's at Samuel Anderson Clinic in Area 3. That's at Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And a man I worked for, Ed Yates. He contracted phrenia, and that turned into acute paranoia. Waldo Dangerfield, another buddy of mine. Gloria Milstein, a girl I knew. She's, God knows where, but she was spotted by means of a psych test when she was applying for a typing job. The federal people picked her up. She was short, dark-haired, very attractive, and no one ever guessed until the test showed up. And John Franklin Mann, a used car salesman I knew. He tested out as a dilapidated phrenic and was carted off, I think, to Kasanin, because he's got relatives in Missouri. And Marge Morrison, another girl I knew. She's out again. I'm sure she was cured at Kasanin. All of them who went to Kasanin seemed as good as new to me, if not better. Kasanin didn't merely meet the requirements of the McKesson Act. It genuinely healed, or so it seemed to me. Dr. Nizia wrote down Kasanin Clinic at KC on the government forms,
and I breathed a sigh of relief.
Yes, he murmured. Kansas City is said to be good. The president spent 2 months there, you know.
I did hear that, I admitted. Everyone knew the heroic story of the president's bout with mental illness in his mid-teens, with his subsequent triumph during his 20s.
And now, before we separate, Dr. Nizia said, I'd like to tell you a little about the magna mater type of schizophrenia.
Good, I said. I'd be anxious to hear.
As a matter of fact, it has been my special interest, Dr. Nizia said. I did several monographs on it. You know the Anderson theory, which identifies each subform of schizophrenia with a subform of religion.
I nodded. The Anderson view of phrenia had been popularized in almost every slick magazine in America. It was the current fashion.
The primary form which phrenia takes is the heliocentric form, the sun worship form, where the sun is deified, is seen, in fact, as the patient's father. You have not experienced that. The heliocentric form is the most primitive and fits with the earliest known religion, solar worship, including the great heliocentric cult of the Roman period, Mithraism. Also, the earlier Persian solar cult, the worship of Mazda.
Yes, I said, nodding.
Now, the magna mater, the form you have, was the great female deity cult of the Mediterranean at the time of the Mycenaean civilization. Ishtar, Sibyl, Attis, then later Athene herself, finally the Virgin Mary. What has happened to you is that your anima, that is, the embodiment of your unconsciousness, its archetype, has been projected outward onto the cosmos, and there it is perceived and worshipped.
I see, I said.
There, it is experienced as a dangerous, hostile, and incredibly powerful, yet attractive being, the embodiment of all the pairs of opposites. It possesses the totality of life, yet is dead, all love, yet is cold, all intelligence, yet is given to a destructive analytical trend, which is not creative, yet it is seen as the source of creativity itself. These are the opposites which slumber in the unconscious, which are transcended by gestalts in consciousness. When the opposites are experienced directly, as you are experiencing them, they cannot be fathomed or dealt with. They will eventually disrupt your ego and annihilate it. For, as you know, in their original form, they are archetypes and cannot be assimilated by the ego.
I see, I said.
So this battle is the great struggle of the conscious mind to come to an understanding with its own collective aspects, its unconsciousness, and is doomed to fail. The archetypes of the unconscious must be experienced indirectly through the anima and in a benign form free of their bipolar qualities. For this to come about, you must hold an utterly different relationship to your unconscious. As it stands, you're passive, and it possesses all the powers of decision.
Right, I said.
Your consciousness has been impoverished so that it no longer can act. It has no authority except that which it derives from unconsciousness, and right now it is split off from unconsciousness, so no rapport can be established by way of the anima.
Dr. Nizia concluded,
you have a relatively mild form of phrenia, but it is still a psychosis and still requires treatment at a federal clinic. I'd like to see you again when you get back from Kansas City. I know the improvement in your condition will be phenomenal.
He smiled at me with genuine warmth, and I smiled back at him. Standing, he held out his hand, and we shook. I was on my way to the Kasanin Clinic at Kansas City. In a formal hearing before witnesses, Dr. Nizia presented me with a summons, asking if there was any reason why I should not be taken at once to Kansas City. These legal formalities had a chilly quality that made me more anxious to be on my way than ever. Nizia offered me a 24-hour period in which to conclude my business affairs, but I declined it. I wanted to leave at once. In the end, we settled on 8 hours. Plane reservations were made for me by Nizia's staff, and I left the bureau in a taxi to return to Ontario until it was time for me to take my big trip east. I had the taxi take me to Maury's house, where I had left a good part of my possessions.
Soon I was at the door, knocking. No one was home. I tried the knob. It was unlocked. So I let myself into the silent, deserted house. There in the bathroom was the tile mural which Pris had been working on that first night. It was done now. For a time I stood staring up at it, marveling at the colors and the design itself. The mermaid and fish, the octopus with shoe-button bright eyes. She had finished him at last. One blue tile had become loose. I plucked it entirely off, rubbed the sticky stuff from its back, and put it in my coat pocket. In case I should forget you, I thought to myself. You and your bathroom mural, your mermaid with pink-tiled tits, your many lovely and monstrous creations bobbing and alive beneath the surface of the water. The placid, eternal water. She had done the line above my head, almost 8 feet high. Above that, sky. Very little of it. The sky played no role in the scheme of creation here. As I stood there, I heard from the front of the house a thumping and banging. Someone was after me, but I remained where I was. What did it matter? I waited, and presently, Maury Rock came rushing in, panting. Seeing me, he stopped short.
Louis Rosen, he said, and in the bathroom.
I'm just leaving.
A neighbor phoned me at the office. She saw you pull up in a cab and enter, and she knew I wasn't home.
Spying on me. I was not surprised. They all are, everywhere I go. I continued to stand, hands in my pockets, gazing up at the wall of color.
She just thought I ought to know. I figured it was you.
He saw, then, my suitcase and the articles I'd collected.
You're really nuts. You barely get back here from Seattle. When did you get in? Couldn't be before this morning, and now you're off again somewhere else.
I said, I have to go, Maury. It's the law. He stared at me, his jaw dropping gradually. Then he flushed.
I'm sorry, Louis. I mean, saying you were a nut.
Yes, but I am. I took the Benjamin Proverb test and the block thing today and couldn't pass either one. The commitment's already been served on me. Rubbing his jaw, he murmured,
Who turned you in?
My father and Chester.
Hell's bells. Your own blood.
Well, they saved me from paranoia. Listen, Maury. I turned to face him. Do you know where she is?
If I did, honest to God, Louis, I'd tell you, even if you have been certified.
You know where they're sending me for therapy?
Kansas City?
I nodded.
Maybe you'll find her there. Maybe the mental health people caught up with her and sent her back and forgot to let me know about it.
Yeah, maybe so, I said. Coming up to me, he whacked me on the back.
Good luck, you son of a bitch. I know you'll pull out of it. You got Freenia, I presume. That's all there is anymore.
I've got Magna Mater Freenia. Reaching into my coat, I got out the tile and showed it to him, saying, To remember her, I hope you don't mind. It's your house and mural, after all.
Take it. Take a whole fish. Take a tit.
He started toward the mermaid.
No kidding, Louis. We'll pry a pink tit loose and you can carry that around with you, okay?
This is fine. We both stood awkwardly facing each other for a time.
How's it feel to be Frenic?
Maury said at last.
Bad, Maury. Very, very bad.
That's what I thought. That's what Pris always said. She was glad to get over it.
That going to Seattle, that was it coming on. What they call catatonic excitement, a sense of urgency, that you have to do something. It always turns out to be the wrong thing. It accomplishes nothing. And you realize that, and then you have panic, and then you get it. The real psychosis. I heard voices and saw. I broke off.
What did you see?
Pris.
Christ,
Maury said. Will you drive me to the airport?
Oh, sure, buddy, sure.
He nodded vigorously. I don't have to go until late tonight, so maybe we could have dinner together. I don't feel like seeing my family again after what happened. I'm sort of ashamed. Maury said,
How come you speak so rationally if you're a Frenic?
I'm not under tension right now, so I've been able to focus my attention. That's what an attack of schizophrenia is. A weakening of attention so that unconscious processes gain mastery and take over the field. They capture awareness, very archaic processes, archetypal, such as non-schizophrenics haven't had since they were 5.
You think crazy things like everyone's against you and you're the center of the universe?
No, I said. Dr. Nizia explained to me that it's the heliocentric schizophrenics who...
Nizia? Raglan Nizia? Of course. By law, you'd have to see him. He's the one who sent Pris up back in the beginning. He gave her the Vygotsky-Luria block test in his own office, personally. I always wanted to meet him.
Brilliant man, and very humane.
Are you dangerous?
Only if I'm riled.
Should I leave you, then?
I guess so, I said. But I'll see you tonight, here at the house, for dinner. About 6. That'll give us time to make the flight.
Can I do anything for you? Get you anything?
Nah. Thanks anyhow. Maury hung around the house for a little while, and then I heard the front door slam. The house became silent once more. I was alone as before. Presently, I resumed my slow packing. Maury and I had dinner together, and then he drove me to the Boise airfield in his white Jaguar. I watched the streets go by, and every woman that I saw looked, for an instant at least, like Pris. Each time I thought it was, but it wasn't. Maury noticed my absorption, but said nothing. The flight which the mental health people had obtained for me was first class, and on the new Australian rocket, the C-80. The Bureau, I reflected, certainly had plenty of the public's funds to disperse. It took only 30 minutes to reach the Kansas City airport, so before 9 that night, I was stepping from the rocket, looking around me for the mental health people who were supposed to receive me. At the bottom of the ramp, a young man and woman approached me, both of them wearing gay, bright Scotch plaid coats. These were my party. In Boise, I'd been instructed to watch for the coats.
Mr. Rosen, the young man said expectantly.
Right, I said, starting across the field toward the building. One of them fell in on either side of me.
A bit chilly tonight,
the girl said. They were not over 20, I thought. Two clear-eyed youngsters who undoubtedly had joined the FBMH out of idealism and were doing their heroic task right this moment. They walked with brisk, eager steps, moving me toward the baggage window, making low-keyed conversation about nothing in particular. I would have felt relaxed by it, except that in the glare of the beacons which guided the ships in, I could already see that the girl looked astonishingly like Pris.
"What's your name?" I asked her.
"Julie," she said. "And this is Ralph."
Do you remember a patient you had here a few months ago? A young woman from Boise named Pris Frauenzimmer?
"I'm sorry," Julie said. "I just came to the Kasanen Clinic last week. We both did."
She indicated her companion.
"We just joined the Mental Health Corps this spring."
"Do you enjoy it?" I asked. "Did it work out the way you had expected?"
"Oh, it's terribly rewarding,"
the girl said breathlessly.
"Isn't it, Ralph?"
He nodded.
"We wouldn't drop out for anything."
"Do you know anything about me?" I asked, as we stood waiting for the baggage machine to serve up my suitcases.
"Only that Dr. Shedd will be working with you," Ralph said. "And he's superb," Julie said. "You'll love him, and he does so much for people. He has performed so many cures."
My suitcases appeared. Ralph took one and I took the other, and we started through the building toward the street entrance. "This is a nice airport," I said. "I never saw it before."
"They just completed it this year," Ralph said. "It's the first able to handle both domestic and extra T flights. You'll be able to leave for the moon right from here."
"Not me," I said, but Ralph did not hear me. Soon we were in a copter, the property of the Kasanen Clinic, flying above the rooftops of Kansas City. The air was cool and crisp, and below us a million lights glowed in countless patterns and aimless constellations, which were not patterns at all, only clusters. "Do you think," I said, "that every time someone dies, a new light winks on in Kansas City?" Both Ralph and Julie smiled at my witticism.
Do you two know what would have happened to me? I said. If there was no compulsory mental health program, I'd be dead by now. This all saved my life, literally. To that, the two of them smiled once more. Thank God the McKesson Act passed Congress, I said. They both nodded solemnly. You don't know what it's like, I said, to have the catatonic urgency, that craving. It drives you on, and then all at once you collapse. You know you're not right in the head. You're living in a realm of shadows. In front of my father and brother, I had intercourse with a girl who didn't exist, except in my mind. I heard people commenting about us while we were doing it, through the door. Ralph asked, You did it through the door?
He heard them commenting, he means, Julie said. The voices that took note of what he was doing and expressed disapproval. Isn't that it, Mr. Rosen?
Yes, I said. And it's a measure of the collapse of my ability to communicate that you had to translate that. At one time, I could easily have phrased that in a clear manner. It wasn't until Dr. Nizia got to the part about the Rolling Stone that I saw what a break had come about between my personal language and that of my society. And then I understood all the trouble I had been having up to then.
Ah, yes, Julie said. Number 6 in the Benjamin Proverb test.
I wonder which proverb Pris missed years ago, I said, that caused Nizia to single her out.
Who is Pris? Julie asked.
I would think, Ralph said, that she's the girl with whom he had intercourse. You hit the nail on the head, I told him. She was here once before either of you. Now she's well again. They discharged her on parole. She's my great mother, Dr. Nizia says. My life is devoted to worshiping Pris, as if she were a goddess. I've projected her archetype onto the universe. I see nothing but her. Everything else to me is unreal. This trip we're taking, you two, Dr. Nizia, the whole Kansas City Clinic, it's all just shadows. There seemed to be no way to continue the conversation after what I had said, so we rode the rest of the distance in silence.